dealt with the problem of defining a conscience, and particularly a religious conscience, which presumably is at the root of other expressions of conscience. And today I suggested that we ought to explore for a few moments the impact of organization on religion and politics, and the impact of religion and politics on organization. I like to call this particular discussion politics in religion and religion in politics. That is to say, all religious organization is also political organization, as we defined politics earlier. And on the other hand, all organization tends to idolize organization, to make it central, and thus to make it religious, you see. So it's the interplay of these two factors in human existence that I'd like for us to look at for a few moments. Religion in politics and politics in religion. Now there are, it seems to me, four factors that are involved in this interchange, so to speak, between the two sides. There's first of all organization in itself, its impact upon both the practice of religion and the practice of general politics, is over against what you might call religious politics. Organization has a way of intruding itself or limiting factors involved in religious belief and in religious practice. Organization is necessary on the one hand if we're going to embody religious belief in practice, so it could be argued, but at the same time, as we've already suggested several times, several of you have suggested, while it seems to be necessary, certain forms of it seem to kill the very spirit for which it supposedly exists. Well, organization is one factor, then, that we'll want to consider. A second factor is class. That is, what kinds of classes are represented in religious groups. The ideology of a religious group will, in some measure, be shaped or conditioned. I don't like to say determined, but conditioned or shaped to some degree by its class composition. I'd like to illustrate that in a moment in connection, for example, with the rise of early Christianity and the class element in early Christianity. But everywhere this seems to be true. You'll find, for example, a close correlation between class background and the way in which religious belief is often expressed. That is, upper class religious groups, groups dominated by upper classes, will express their religious feelings or beliefs in quite different ways, or tend to, I always add tend to, than so-called lower economic classes. In this country, for example, the statistics seem to show that the per capita income, for example, of certain religious denominations is much higher than that of others. Presbyterians, for example, are one of the highest, for example. Roman Catholics will rank somewhere in the middle in terms of per capita income. Unitarians are pretty far up, too. How this will affect religious observance and religious belief, of course, is one of the objectives of anyone who studies our subject. So class composition of a religious group we should keep in mind as we look at this subject. Then also, it seems to me, you have the factor of specialization of labor, which plays an important role. We argued the other day that both politics and religion, in a sense, are holistic. That is, they try to grapple, so to speak, with the problems of life as wholes. They're not specialized, in a sense, in one sense of the term. Religion, presumably, is an integrating factor for our eternal concerns, if you wish to put it that way, our spiritual concerns. Politics, an integrating factor for ordering the temporal realm, so to speak. Yet, when you organize, either in religion or politics, you begin to specialize. That is, organization and specialization of labor go hand in hand, it seems. When you begin to specialize, the religious leader takes on a different characteristic from what he would have in a relatively unspecialized religious society. And that I'll try to illustrate during our discussion. The factor of specialization of labor is particularly important in connection with religion and politics, because as organization becomes tighter in general, in religious groups, as that tends to happen, the lay character of religion tends to decline. In other words, the responsibility of individuals for religious progress or religious development tends to be shifted onto the experts. And when the experts bear the great burden, so to speak, of religious life, it means that the great mass of us are left out here, for example, relying on the experts and no longer on our own religious emphases. Now, the same is true, of course, in politics. Particularly if you have a democratic ideology, it is perilous to specialize too much, because specialization of labor inevitably leads to machinery for coordinating the labor that has been specialized. You have to coordinate what's been broken apart. But when you begin to coordinate the labor that has been broken apart or split up, then you tend to get bureaucracy, and bureaucracy has certain laws of its own, the coordinating bureaucracy of any organization, built upon a high degree of specialization of labor. And as the bureaucracy goes off on its own, it becomes autonomous, as we say, it loses its sense of responsibility to the whole community. It becomes an end in itself, with results as disastrous for the political realm as they are for the religious realm. So specialization, keep in mind specialization of labor as a very, very important factor in affecting how we express our religious beliefs and how we endeavor to implement them. Now, the last general factor, it seems to me, is the factor of money, as you might expect. With a high degree of specialization of labor, a high degree of organization, you almost inevitably get a money economy of some sort. It's not without reason that great religious leaders have warned us against money. Economists, profound economists too, for example, have warned us against money, because it, while money perhaps is essential to conduct interchange or trade or commerce, becomes a matter of convenience, and it is an abominable store of value, as anyone who lives through inflation will know, and it too tends to become an idol. When anything tends to become an idol, it means that the individual who idolizes it tends to become stupid. So that money is often associated, especially if you have a high degree of organization, high degree of specialization of labor, money tends to distort and corrupt, I suppose you could say, both religious values and political values. It's as dangerous in political society and as it is in religious society. Now, if you keep in mind these four factors, what I'd like to do is to illustrate, more or less from history, how it seems to me they can be related to developments in religious and political history. These will simply be illustrations, and you may differ with me on how they could or should be interpreted. But for whatever they're worth, I'd like now to turn to these illustrations and tend to show how they are related to our interpretation of religion and politics and to these four factors. I might add before we get into these illustrations that one of the best known of the sociologists of religion of the last 100 years, Ernst Troeltsch, some of you may know his work on the social teaching of the Christian churches, has suggested that there is a typology, so to speak, within which religious organizations fit. He calls one typology the sect type, and the other typology the church type. The sect type is one where the emphasis is upon purity of belief and action, high demands, so to speak, or strict demands on individuals. The organization remains small under those circumstances because you refuse to compromise, presumably. So it's the sect, by definition, becomes a small group with rather strict standards for its members, particularly in personal conduct and so on. As you move over in the other direction, you get larger and larger, but your doctrine, or what you hold people to in your group, tends to become more and more loose. So you purchase universality over here on this end at the expense of insisting on certain ethical demands, you see, as part of your membership in the group. Now, if you keep in mind that kind of typology, perhaps most religious organizations fall in here in between someplace, then I'd like to turn now to the illustrations that I suggested we'd be using. The first refers to the historical example that we cited the other day when we were dealing with the historical background of religious organization and in relationship to politics. I refer, for example, to the editor's comments in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, on the rise of the Hebrew monarchy, the ancient Hebrew monarchy, because I think it's an illustration of the interrelationship of these four factors that I referred to in ancient Hebrew history and religion. Remember that it was the people who demanded a monarch, supposedly. And it was the prophet, or at least the judge, Samuel, who declined to give them a monarch. Wasn't God himself enough of a monarch, you see? Wasn't theocracy, ruled by divinity rather than by man, sufficient? Now, the background, we're told historically, for the rise of the ancient Hebrew monarchy was the development of trade and commerce in a considerable degree. The old tribal system broke down. And it was precisely at that point that the demands for a greater degree of centralization in organization and in the monarch began to be made. And eventually Samuel conceded the monarchy as a last resort. But then you remember he gave that famous sermon from which we quoted the other day, predicting what the monarch would do to the Hebrew people. He will take your virgins for his harem, for example. Solomon, of course, was to have 300 wives and 700 concubines. How he handled that, I never will be able to understand. But this was predicted, presumably, by Samuel. He will conscript your young men for the army. In Solomon's reign, you get an expansion of the ancient Hebrew Empire, for example. He will tax you and tax you and tax you, said Samuel. So, and there was a great tension, of course, between the ancient tribal way of life, where money was a small factor, you see. Barter was the way in which you exchanged, cooperation at the local level, and a trading society with a king at its head and with a tendency to centralization. Now, lo and behold, everything that Samuel predicted happened, presumably. The biblical scholars tell us that probably many of those passages were written long after the events themselves, probably by some editors who were living in Babylon after the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, beginning in 586 before the present era began. And they looked back upon Hebrew history, and they tried to point out the lessons for the Jews living in Babylon. Namely, don't centralize your economy. Don't centralize the monarchy. Don't over-organize, and so on. These will be the results if you do, you see. They were a little bit unclear as to what the alternative was, for example. Does this mean you restrict trade, you restrict commerce, you restrict specialization of labor, or what? But at any rate, they saw a lesson in that development, which became part and parcel, for example, of the two books of the Chronicles in the Hebrew Bible, which are often dated, as I recall, to the period after the exile, when the monarchy is gone and temporal independence, political independence, is still fragile. You have to turn then, presumably, to other resources. You can no longer rely on organization. All through, it seems to me, Hebrew prophecy, this note runs in one way or another, that you can't put too much confidence in organization. It may be necessary, or in money, but if you put too much confidence in it, it's bound to fail, for example. And I think this is the explanation for the many warnings in the prophets against idolatry. I used to think when I read the prophets that they had in mind a literal making of images. Well, they had that in mind, but that's the least important aspect of the notion of idolatry in the prophets, it seems to me. The most important aspect is the tendency of human beings to idolize the works of their hands, their technology, their institutions, their money, and so on, to make them central, to worship them. It's at that point that you lose a sense of responsibility, and you lose, in a sense, also your capacity as a human being. You become inhuman, in a sense. And this was the central theme of prophecy. Even Jeremiah, for example, in the 7th century, when he prophesied against the Babylonians, coupled with that prophecy, a statement that the Judeans, or the citizens of Judah, should not resist the king of Babylon, which is a peculiar political doctrine at that time, and still, I think, has not been fully interpreted. But Jeremiah and all the other prophets had in mind this tendency to idolize two different kinds of things. And the idolatry would lead to disaster if persisted in, temporal disaster, to idolize the things of nature, to make nature, so to speak, a god. And secondly, to idolize our mechanical and social technology. When you do that, then stupidity results. This is the basis, it seems to me, of the many warnings among the ancient Hebrew prophets, the many warnings against the technology of the Egyptians. The Egyptians had invented a wonderful war chariot, for example, which had blades extending out from the wheels of the chariot. And of course, when the chariot rushed into the battlefield, the blades turned round and round and sliced people to bits. It was one of the marvels of the ancient world. And the Hebrews, being poor people, envied the Egyptians for building such chariots of war. But the prophets are always warning, don't put your confidence in the Egyptian war chariot. It will fail you. This is what Jeremiah was constantly saying. But it was a hard lesson to learn. Well, at any rate, that's one illustration that occurs to me from the Bible that I would mention. Now, there's another one from the Hebrew Bible that I'd like briefly to refer to. That is the dilemma of reform, religious reform in ancient Israel. I refer to the Deuteronomic reform that occurred in the 7th century, supposedly, about 621. When there are various accounts of it, of course, and there's no necessary agreement among scholars, but what happened was that a young king came to the throne under advisors who were parts of the reforming party. And when he came to the throne, the advisors decided it was time to put into effect certain reforms, both in the state and in the religious organization. One of the reforms they decided was necessary was to centralize worship in Jerusalem. Don't allow it to be decentralized out here again on the high places, as the prophets refer to them, because then it becomes corrupt. The people around you will inveigle you into worshiping their gods. Whereas if you centralize it in Jerusalem, it can come under the control of a centralized bureaucracy. So one of the reforms presumably was that movement toward a centralization of worship. But there was a dilemma, of course, as I read the story. The reform might protect you against corruption by the other gods of surrounding peoples, but it would also destroy the sense of flexibility and spontaneity that decentralization would provide. Hence, we infer that a great many Hebrew leaders opposed the reform, not because they were anti-reform in general, but because they saw what might happen to the religious life of Judah if you do centralize a worship in Jerusalem. Well, I could go on and on. There have been a lot of disputes about that reform, but the point that I'm trying to suggest is that you always pay a price in centralization of organization, whether it's in religion or politics. You pay a price with a decentralized scheme also. And that should be kept in mind. In religion, a centralization tends to create rigidity, tends to create inadaptability, for example. And the same is true in politics. Let me illustrate also the theme of our discussion this morning by referring to what happened between primitive Christianity and medieval Christianity, some of the things that go on in that period. There was some interest expressed in that subject a couple of days ago, and so I'm using it here to illustrate the interplay again of organization, belief, and practice that we're concerned with. As we reconstruct the history of primitive Christianity, it was a highly decentralized society, so to speak, scattered congregations of various kinds with no central control at all. Presumably they were held together by apostolic letters of various kinds, the kinds you find reflected in the letters of Paul, for example. This meant that there was no unified scheme for collecting money. Specialization of labor was at a low level, generally speaking, laymen controlled. There was no distinction between ministers and laymen, between priests and laymen. Few laymen, to be sure, had a kind of prestige as I try to reconstruct this story, but that's about all. While there was no centralized organization, therefore, there was plenty of spontaneity in the first century. People would have dreams and visions and then spout them out and act according to them. There was no authority to say this is a false teaching or this is a true teaching, so to speak, because there was a belief in the inspiration, the direct inspiration that often came to individuals, which took the form often of speaking in tongues, for example. So it was a highly spontaneous kind of religious society with both the benefits and the weaknesses. There was no differentiation, for example, in ecclesiastical office between, for example, the presbyter and the bishop, as far as we're able to see. In fact, all offices themselves were rather vaguely defined. Now, what happened? What happened between, let's say, about 50 AD, if this was the picture of the early church, and 350 AD or 450 AD? What developed that changed the character of the church, of the ecclesiastical organization? See, it's the same kind of problem that the Hebrews confronted, in a sense, in their ecclesiastical and political organization. Well, for one thing that happened was, of course, that the belief structure of the church was radically changed, or at least the practice of the church was radically changed in that 400-year period. The early Christians, as far as we're able to reconstruct their beliefs, rejected war. Many of them rejected private property, not all of them, but some of them rejected private property, for example. Many of them rejected very much of a hierarchy in religious organization, for instance. And obviously they rejected idolatry. They excluded many occupations from those which Christians could enter, as I pointed out before. Certainly, for example, couldn't be a gladiator, couldn't be a teacher in many cases because the teacher was in charge of the civic cult. You couldn't be a soldier because you had to kill criminals and you had to go to war and so on. A whole body of primitive beliefs existed in 50 AD. Couldn't become a magistrate because the magistrate ordered people to be killed or constrained. By 450 AD, these beliefs have faded. Now, what's happened to organization in the meantime, ecclesiastical organization? Well, you can expect what's happened, or you can anticipate what's happened. It's become tighter and tighter and more centralized, for example. The church has grown enormously. It's a kind of imperial structure by 450 as compared with the relative simplicity of the early period. How did that happen? Well, here again, you see, I think the sociologist of religion would refer to my four factors, and some combination of them at least affected profoundly what the character of the belief system and the nature of the church happened to be. Let me spell out some of the things that happened in that 400-year period. First of all, rich people began to enter the church. The early church was primarily, we used to say primarily slaves, that's no longer believed, but there were a lot of slaves in the early church, and there were a lot of, quote, lower class people. It's true there were always some intellectuals like St. Paul and others, but they were vastly inundated, I suppose you could say, by the poor. Now, the sociologists of religion tell us that typical ideologies of poor people include an upturning, overturning, so to speak, of all existing social orders when they think politically or think socially. And this seems to have been the characteristic of the early church, that it had a very large infusion of separation of people from the external world. The external world was often referred to as the world. And the Christian was regarded as beyond the world, particularly the beyond the world of pomp and ceremony and power and centralized structure and war, for example. So you find again and again the documents of the early period saying, we set ourselves over against the world. Or as the epistle to the Philippians says, our true home is in heaven, so to speak. It's a separate city of which we are members. Now, as those from the upper classes began to join the church, and the interesting question is, why did they join such an organization? We might not get into that in the discussion period, but they did. By 300, they're beginning to dominate now in the church. With that comes centralization, comes a greater emphasis upon money, comes greater specialization of labor. For example, by about 400 AD, there's a clear distinction now, even before then, but I'm going to be safe, say certainly about 400, a clear distinction between a bishop and a presbyter. There's a professional religious hierarchy that is now arisen in many respects by 450. And along with that, not necessarily as cause and effect, the early strict doctrines about the world have been greatly attenuated, greatly weakened. Among those, for example, is that Christians now not only can enter the army, but there's a statute passed early in the 5th century which says that non-Christians are not allowed to enter the army now, for example. You get, in addition to the repudiation of pacifism, you get a great deal of compromise with attitudes to wealth and to property, for example. The early church fathers were, if not communists, at least very, very critical of the institution of private property. By now, this has begun to fade. Private property begins to be justified more or less wholeheartedly, and so on, by 450. Somehow, in other words, there's a correlation, even if you don't wish to call it causation, between the changing structure of the church and the belief system that is held. What happens to authority, the notion of religious authority, for example, in this early period? The early period, as I said, a person could spout off as a messenger of God, more or less spontaneously. If two people spouted contradictory messages coming from God, then there was always the authority of the apostle to settle that issue. As long as the apostles lived, it's down presumably to about, not later than 100 AD, they'd have to be pretty old to have lived that long. long as they live, they can mediate, you see, between two contradictory messages, spontaneous messages. What happened when they died? Well, you had to find someone else to do the mediating. And so there arose the doctrine of the apostolic succession, which greatly expands the bishop's power in the church, the authority of the bishop. And with the authority of the bishop expanding, it means that the degree of spontaneity in religious expression slowly declines, particularly as laymen come to be sharply separated from the clergy. You have all those characteristics that I talked about earlier in my talk now being reflected in both the changing doctrine and the changing structure of the church. But of course, with this changing doctrine, with these less onerous demands put on the ordinary Christian, greater flexibility, greater compromise, for example, could not hold office, he could enter the army, and so on. With all that loosening of the tightness of the sect type in the early centuries will come vast expansion of numbers. Comes larger and larger and larger. Success then begins to be measured in terms of the numbers of good Christians who are baptized, even if they've given up much of what they originally believed and decreased the rigor of the standards that they had espoused. That which brings you then to the medieval compromises that we talked about the other day, and I won't go over that ground again, but except to remind you of some of the compromises that did take place. First of all, there's a vast expansion of what I suppose you could say are non-ethical kinds of things. That is, for example, the number of sacraments is expanded. This doesn't affect conduct any. In the beginning, the church had two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper, for example. It wasn't until about 1000 A.D. that there came to be seven sacraments. Why seven? Could have been eight, could have been six, I don't know. Except seven is a sacred number somehow. So you get a vast expansion of the ritualistic side, you see, and a decline in the ethical dimension as the power and the specialization, the sheer extent of the church develops. Illustrating, in other words, what I've been trying to suggest, or what we tried to suggest the other day. Of course, the epitomization, I suppose you could say, of what now becomes a kind of coercive church is the Inquisition, with all that's implied there, and the attempt to force statements of belief on human beings. That attempt to force statements of belief would have undoubtedly made the early leaders of the church turn over in their graves. But by the 13th century, it becomes accepted as a part of Christian belief. I've often thought, for example, in the 13th century, what an anomaly it is to find ecclesiastical leaders pleading or soldiers to go on the crusade in the name of the Prince of Peace. You get that kind of paradox and irony. And some of the descriptions of what happened, for example, as the crusaders conquered Jerusalem, make your stomach turn. One description, for example, talks about foot-high blood flowing in the streets as he gloatingly kills the Islamic defenders, for example, or the so-called Western soldiers killing Islamic defenders. And all this in the name of the Prince of Peace. It illustrates a very interesting proposition, I think, among human beings, how they can perfectly sincerely say one thing and do exactly the opposite. I think this whole problem of the sociology of religion is fascinating from that point of view, although it is also depressing. Let me illustrate use another illustration from the group that I'm affiliated with, the Religious Society of Friends, are the Quakers. Something happened to the Quakers between their foundation in the 17th century and what they became by the end of the 18th century. What happened to them is epitomized in the name of a book written by a Quaker historian. It's called From Meeting House to Counting House. And it illustrates Max Weber's contention that the very virtues, so to speak, of many of the early sectarians, like the Quakers in the 17th century, led to their corruption. This is another kind of paradox. One of the virtues was to live an abstemious life. There was a strong Puritan tendency among Quakers, for example, although they were not Puritans in the usual sense of the term. Simplicity was the key to Quakerism, Quaker faith in the 17th century. Simplify, simplify, as Thoreau used to say. Well, the Quakers had said it a long time before. Well, those very virtues, of course, simplicity, abstemiousness, don't bedeck yourself in the gaudy things of the world, and so on, led to their accumulating money. How can you help it, you know, under those circumstances? But as they accumulated money and became more and more involved in high finance, what happened to the clarity of their original teaching? And the argument of this particular book is it became seriously modified, and while they were still philanthropic in a general way, they no longer had the passion for religious and social reform they had in the first generation. How do you prevent this happening? It's one of the questions that can always be raised. Let me illustrate it in another area. I'm almost finished. In Leninism, for example, take Leninism. Leninism is often regarded as a political credo, but it's also religious, because no sooner do you establish or do you eliminate belief in God, for example, than you have to find some sort of a substitute. And this is what's happened, of course, in the politics of communism. The ultimate goal of a communist is very much like the ultimate goal of many religious persons. It's a kind of free society, association of free societies. International in scope, perhaps. This is more or less what Marxism has held up as its ideal. And many religious groups have. Well, now, how do you get that? Well, Lenin says, you get it by a doctrine of what he calls democratic centralism. That is to say, you organize the party in such a way, instead of party or church here at this point, you see, both any other name as well as sweet. According to the principle that you debate thoroughly a given issue, and then the decision is made at the center of the structure, decision of what you should do and what the policy is going to be of the party. At that point, everyone must shut up and carry out the decision of the parties without criticism. Well, obviously, you can see what's going to happen. Here you're using the device of centralization of organization to attain a goal of decentralization. The question is raised, of course, again. If you choose means radically contradictory to the ends you keep in mind, you have in mind, can you possibly attain those ends? And that occurs and recurs in the history of religious and political organization. We never seem to be able to learn that lesson, at least as I see it. We never seem to be able to do it. Plenty of groups today exist who say, the only way to get peace is to prepare for war, for example. My reading of history is if you prepare for war, you're going to get it. But obviously many intelligent, highly insightful people will say, no, you have to prepare for war if you're going to have peace. It's an ancient Latin statement, ancient Roman statement, which is repeated ad infinitum today. The means somehow are must be related to the ends, must not be radically different from the ends, or if they are radically different from the ends are going to be corrupted, and you're never going to attain them. But you see that again and again, I think, in religious organization, as well as in political organization. One of the tendencies of religious organization, of course, is to destroy quite often a sense of responsibility on the part of religious people. As specialization becomes more and more evident, then we want to thrust responsibility on others. So you get the notion, of course, of the professional holy man upon whom you can rely to carry out your salvation. There are a great many religious groups in the world, of course, who see that very acutely. It seems to me the Jewish tradition has always emphasized or has tended to emphasize a great degree of decentralization, for instance. The Islamic tradition has emphasized very loose organization too, except during the period of the caliphate, but they're very much like Jewish congregations in that respect. There is a story that I like to quote that illustrates this problem, I think, of our tendency to want to shelve responsibility for religious obligation on others. The story has to do with Jesus' arrival.